thank you for joining us for this chapel message from the campus of Columbia International University in Columbia, South Carolina. Our mission at CIU is to educate people from a biblical worldview to impact the nations with the message of Christ.
Good morning. I feel like I've been in church. I know I've been in church. Amen. I preach in the name of God, who looks beyond our faults and see our needs. When I was coming up here, I said, you know, I ought to give a little testimony before I speak, you know. About 6 months ago, I had cervical spinal surgery. Didn't have any problems before surgery. When I came out of surgery, I couldn't stand. I couldn't walk. I couldn't feed myself. And I just want to say, I'm going to give a shout out to the goodness of the Lord. Ain't he all right? Ain't he all right? So I'm here because of God's grace and mercy. I want to just share briefly with you just some information. You know, Black History Month has become somewhat controversial. People wanted to associate it with critical race theory, in essence. Dr. Carter G. Woodson, back in 26 or so, he started Black History Month, and in 1976, President Gerald Ford issued a proclamation declaring Black History Month for February. And when you think about Black History Month, you know, some people say, why do you need it? I grew up in Eastern North Carolina. And when I grew up, there were color fountains, white fountains, color restrooms, white restrooms, and Black people had to go into the back door of facilities and places. In my school, we had hand-me-down books. We had books that were passed down from the white schools. The band uniform were raggedy uniforms that the white kids had worn. In my chemistry department, there was one microscope, and it didn't work. And you didn't really see, you really didn't see African Americans in any prominent position. This is in the South. You know, I have relatives who were in the North during the same time I was growing up. They went to integrated schools. We didn't go to integrated schools, you know. It was a written policy that you knew your place in society. And the place wasn't really comfortable. It wasn't progressive. I remember in my history class, I was reading something about Black history, and the only thing I remember in that publication was a photo of African Americans in the General Assembly in South Carolina. And they had their shoes off, they had their feet on top of the desk, and they were wiggling their toes, and they had a liquor bottle on the side. You can probably find that photo in the archives, you know. That's how they portrayed African American people, in essence. Portray people as if you are nothing. You're subhuman. And that's why Dr. Wilson said this is a miseducation of African Americans. We have done more than that. We're not talking about pre-slavery, because before pre-slavery, Africans ran the world. The Greek philosophers went to Africa to learn from the Africans. They were the scientists, the medical people. I read a book, I was in Charleston years ago. I ran across a book. It was entitled The Diary of a Slave Owner. And in that book, it talked about how these slave owners wanted certain African slaves who had certain skills, artistic skills, musical skills, to teach their children, in essence. So African people who came through the triangle of slave trade came from a culture and a society. Sometimes history will tell you that African American people ought to be glad that they were kidnapped and enslaved so that they could have a better life. There was humanity in Africa, those who have read African history. And so that was the environment. While I was in school, the biggest, activity that I had was scouting. I became an Eagle Scout, And I remember I went to the National Jamboree in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania in 1964. And we didn't have enough people to go from my area. So there was a bus came through. It had 30 white Boy Scouts on the bus and two African Americans, including myself. And we went to Valley Forge. We rolled up together. And then when we got to Valley Forge, they had me assigned to a black Boy Scouts troop. So I spent time there, you know. But that's how it was in those days. My father was a World War II veteran. He was a disabled veteran. And so during those times, he wasn't 100% disabled, but he was 30%. So if he were 100% disabled, I would automatically have gotten a VA scholarship. So he was only 30%. And so they had a pool of competitive scholarships for children of veterans who were less than 100%. And there was a white VA representative that talked to my parents and said, you know what? Your son has done very, very well in school. I'm going to push for him to get that scholarship. And that was a wonderful opportunity for me because I was able to go to college, first one in my generation to go to college. And I went to A&T State University, a great experience there. You know, civil rights movement, A&T was the institution that started the sit-in demonstration at Woolworth in Greensboro. So it had a rich history of social justice. And I left A&T and I went to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I had a Ford Fellowship. And I recall there were probably about 40 students in a master's program in city and regional planning. And there was another African American who went to HBC University like me. And we were in this professor's class. And he called us out. It's about 20 people in class. He said, Mr. McLaughlin and Mr. So-and-so, I want y'all to stand up. We stood up. He said, I want to tell you, now it's in front of everybody in class. I mean, he didn't have the courtesy or the common decency to talk with us privately. He said, I want you all to drop this course because you can't pass it. You don't have the aptitude to pass this. And I would suggest that you drop the course. Now, this is one of those required courses, and he's the only one teaching the course. Well, he was telling us that you're not going to graduate. And so, you know, we had a dean of the school that was very progressive. And he said to us very candidly, he said, you know what? I cannot force this professor to take you because he's probably not going to pass you anyway with his attitude. So, but let me work on this for a little while. So he brought in another professor. And that professor was Harvey B. Gantt, the one who desegregated schools in South Carolina when he went to Clemson University in 1963. So Harvey Gantt came in and he was our professor for this class. And we had 20 people in the first class and over half of the people left this professor who felt he couldn't teach African-American people. About half, 10 of the students left that class and went to Mr. Gantt's class, in essence. As you know, he became the first African-American mayor of the city of Charlotte. Very, very fine person, been a mentor for me over the years. And so he said, well, when is it going to stop? Then about 4 years later, I got a Rockefeller Fellowship. I went to the University of Miami in Coral Gables, working on a master's in business administration. So there were like four Rockefeller Fellows from the Southeast. And so three of us stayed together. You know, we were, you know, older people. We studied together and everything else. And I remember we were in this class, and it was an accounting class, I believe. And we had a test, and the professor marked on each of one of our tests a D minus. Didn't have anything else up there, just a letter grade D minus. So we were trying to figure out what was going on. So we went to the professor, and he said to us, well, I think you all cheated. That's why I gave y'all a D minus, in essence. So we said, he said, well, I'm gonna tell you what I think y'all need to do. Y'all don't need to sit together. Why is it that black folks can't sit together? And if they stand together, they're gonna be suspected. I remember during the Civil Rights Movement, they had something called a riot act. If more than three black people stood on the street together, they could be arrested. But anyway, this professor had the audacity to tell us, y'all don't need to sit together. I said, well, how about these white students who sit together all the time? How about them? So, you know, I mean, it just really it just angered me, you know. So what we decided to do, he told us, y'all need to separate. We didn't separate. So he's gonna get smart. So he did three separate tests, test A, test B, test C, gave all separate tests together. And he told us what you make on this test would be your final grade. And we made A's, all three of us. We made A's. And the interesting thing about it was, we didn't tell them this, but there was a white student in the class whose mother taught that same course at Florida International University. And he had the textbook with the answer to the problems. And they would get together, you know, but because we were black, we were the ones that were not honorable. But these guys they knew what was going on, in essence. So, you know, you have a lot of different experiences in life. And then I recall that when I finished the University of Miami, and I came back and I was looking for a job. I remember, it was before computers, you know, laptops, all that kind of stuff, emails. I wrote about 100 applications. And you know what? I did have a few interviews and they told me I was overly qualified. You all probably don't hear that anymore, but told me I was overly qualified. How can you be overly qualified when you're looking for a job? And so, again, you gotta have a support system. I was home in Charlotte at that time and I was shopping. I ran into Mr. Harvey Gantt. And he said to me, he said, Brother McLaughlin, what are you doing with all that education you got? I said, man, I'm looking for a job. He said, what? I said, I'm looking for a job. You know, because people were telling folks, we can't find qualified African-American people. You know, we're gonna talk a little later on about discernment, because people tell you a whole lot of things that are lies and make you believe it's the truth, in essence. So he said, well, have you thought about going to this particular bank? And I said, if I could say anything, he said, I just had dinner a few days ago with the chairman and CEO. And he said, we want to have some diversity and inclusion. We want to find some qualified, that's a hard word for me to get out of my mouth, qualified African-American people. They're talking about qualified people now. We're U.S. Supreme Court nominees, as you all know. Anyway, Harvey Gantt said to me, well, will it be okay if I call the chairman, CEO, and let them know about you? I said, man, please do. Now, I've gone to that place a couple weeks ago. They said, we don't have any jobs. I guess they were saying, in essence, we don't have any jobs for you. They didn't say it that way. But anyway, about 2 days later, I get a call from the senior vice president of HR. Mr. McAuhorn, can you come over? We want to talk with you. So I came over in and was able to get a job there, you know. But it's just really interesting about race in America and the importance of Black History Month, in essence, you know. I remember when President Obama was elected, there were people shouting that we're in a post-racial society. Well, they were saying that racism is not a factor anymore. We have overcome. And then we find out later on with George Floyd and everybody else that sometimes we're not where we ought to be. But when I think about race relations in America, I think about, you know, some situations where it was because people came together regardless of race, to work for the common good. The formation of the National Urban League in 1910. There were African American people were leaving the South around the 1900. They call it the Progressive Era in America. People were leaving the South. They were going to the industrialized communities, the Northeast and other places. They wanted to have a better opportunity for themselves and their children. And so many females went up there to do domestic work, and as a result, people were being dishonest with them, telling them that they had jobs. They didn't really have jobs for them at all. So a group of white females got together and formed the National League for the Protection of Colored Women, because they were outraged by how African-American women were being exploited. And so they came together. And in 1910, that organization merged with a condition on the urban condition of Negroes and became the National Urban League. And the National Urban League has always had biracial support. I think every chair of the National Urban League board since 1910 has been white since 1910. And came together to work. Mary McLeod Bethune, everybody knew about her. They talk about her with Bethune Cookman, a native of South Carolina, but she worked with President Roosevelt. She worked in that administration. When they had a New Deal program, she was able to communicate effectively to President Roosevelt, say, you know, this New Deal is going to pass African-American people unless we have a program that's going to target them. So she headed up an effort in President Roosevelt's administration to promote the FDA program to help others. And you look at many of the African-American institution. You look at Tuskegee. We know that Booker T. Washington came to Tuskegee, but he was supported by the Rockefeller, the Mellis, and other philanthropists who saw the need to promote education for African-American people. So I think when you look at this history, you see a history where people of goodwill have come together to make a difference, to uplift the least of our people. When I think about you as students and others, I think about the three things I want you to think about in trying to determine your role and be prepared to deal with these things, three things. The first one is reality. I'm gonna call them the three R's, because when I was in grammar school, they called the three R's, reading, arithmetic, what it was, writing. Yeah, so the three R's. I've said the first R is reality. You know, the Bible says the truth will set you free. And you know, you read so much information. I had an article that I was looking at yesterday, and it was in U.S. Today, and it was talking about race, gender, undergird court battle. They're talking about, you know, President Biden said he was going to nominate an African-American female for the Supreme Court. President Reagan said the same thing when he was running against Jimmy Carter. He is an African-American, so I'm going to nominate a woman. Sandra Day O'Connor was the first female to go on the Supreme Court. The former president said that he was going to nominate a woman to the Supreme Court. But all of a sudden, because President Biden said he's going to nominate a woman and put an adjective in front of this woman, an African-American woman, people said, that's not right, that's not fair. I know Judge Michelle Childs. She's an Urban League girl. I remember when she finished high school, she won an Urban League scholarship. And when she finished high school, law school, she came back, she served on the Urban League Board of Directors. I remember when she was in college, she got a job through the Urban League during the summer. She is a person that understands us. And I think that, you know, I remember years ago, I brought a professor in from Harvard University to give a lecture. And one of my friends, Dr. Sid Vani at that time at University of South Carolina, said, JT, we don't need another intellect from Harvard University. Well, that's saying that the Supreme Court, we need people who graduated from public institutes, people who, first of all, are qualified. And she's very qualified. So let me say this to you. The first thing in reality, we have to be able to discern what is real. There's so much misinformation out here now. You know, they told people, say, you know what? You get the COVID shot, it's going to kill you. You get a COVID shot, it's going to give you COVID. There are all kinds of misinformation out here. So you have to be seekers of the truth. And all the way you can do that, you got to have the spirit of discernment that you can see what's not obvious, you know? And God will give you the spirit of discernment so you can see what's not evident from the naked eyes, you know? And so I said to you that's the first thing. You got to be seekers of the truth. And the second R is risk. Risk. You got to take risk in life, you know? You know, everybody want to be safe. There's no such thing as being safe. If you believe in God, this is a Christian school. Y'all sung those songs and y'all praise God, you know? I hope it's real. Because God is real. And God got your back. Don't talk about I'm scared of this. How can you be scared when you're doing God's will? You think God's going to abandon you when you're doing his will? And he said in his word, I'll be with you. And he said to Moses, when Moses was trembling, when God tapped him to go to Egypt and tell Pharaoh, let my people go. Moses said, Lord, I'm nervous about that. I don't feel confident in talking to the Pharaoh like that. Don't worry about Moses. I'll speak for you, through you. I'm with you. And I tell you this because the spirit of discernment, I remember, you know, sometimes we have to be still. You know, we want to be moving all around, trying to make decisions, you know. Sometimes you have to be still. I remember, you know, they said that Moses was confronted with Pharaoh's army behind him and the Red Sea in front of him. And the folks were yelling, said, Moses, you just brought us out here to die in the wilderness. You know, you can't listen to these agitators. You know, suppose Moses would listen to them. Now, God has taken them from Egypt now and fed them. Now they complain to Moses that your God done brought us out here to die in the wilderness. And the Spirit said to Moses, be still. You got to be still to receive the spirit of discernment. It will come to you in due time. And the third R is that we have to reconcile ourselves with our people, you know. Anger and hate is a bad thing, young people, old people too. It's bad. It would keep you in bondage, in essence. I remember years ago, I had, if people are going to lie on you, don't worry about it. You're in good company because they lied on Jesus first. So I remember this person wrote a negative, nasty article about me. And my family was all upset, you know. It's bad when your family get upset. And my children were small. They were taking karate. And they said, Dad, they started doing kung fu kicks and everything. I said, Dad, we go with you. We'll get him. We'll fight him. And so, you know, I mean, I don't want to fight anybody. But I had all this pressure mounting that you got to do something, in essence. I remember, Dr. Smith, I went to a prayer breakfast sponsored by the South Carolina General Assembly. And they had a former governor of Kentucky speaking. And he shared a testimony. You know, God will give you your answer, in essence, if you just keep the faith. So here I was. I mean, I might get angry now because I got all this pressure on me that you got to do something. You got to be a man, y'all. You got to stand up. And so I went to this breakfast. Former governor of Kentucky said he was indicted unjustly. And all his friends started moving away from him. You know, we call them fair weather friends. Fair weather friends. They started moving away from him. And went to church. Reverend Finkel, he went to church and said he thought he'd get some support from the church people. And they started whispering about him, acting crazy, you know. And he said early one morning, the Spirit of the Lord came to him and said to him that you need to go out and apologize to all those people who you are angry with because they've been lying on you. He said, I'm confused. He said he was confused. Somebody telling him to go out and apologize to people who've been lying on him and trying to destroy his character. But he kept the faith and said he went to the people and he apologized because the word said that God is the judge. He's going to have him to judge. And you don't need to get try and do God's job. Do your job. You got enough to do your own job. And so he said he went. So I heard that message and I left that breakfast that morning. And within, I guess, 30 minutes, I ran into that person that had been trying to scandalize me, as well as to try to discredit me, in essence. And I saw him, and I walked over to him. I said, man, let me tell you. I said, I want to apologize to you. He said, what you talking about, man? I said, man, I want to apologize to you. I said, I want to apologize to you because I've been hating on you because of all those lies you've told on me and tried to destroy my family. I was wrong. It's not my business to be hating on you. That's between you and God. Please forgive me. And I can tell you the burden was lifted off me. So as I close today, I want to say to you, Dr. King said that the most pressing question that we have is what are we going to do for others? You know, it's not enough to graduate from Columbia International University, not enough to read the scriptures, and not enough to sing beautifully, but what are you going to do to help those who are in need? And that is your challenge, and I think Black History Month represents people coming together, helping each other for a better society. Thank you.
We hope you found this message a blessing to your life. More Columbia International University Chapel messages are available at iTunes and at podcast.ciu.edu. Learn more about CIU's undergraduate, seminary, and graduate programs at our website, ciu.edu. Columbia International University educates people from a biblical worldview to impact the nations with the message of Christ. Thank you for the opportunity to minister to you today.